Alston Street, which is roughly halfway. This second murder was much more terrible in nature. The body was utterly dismembered and organs were removed. The work was very delicate in nature, very skilled, and it was done in darkness, in no more than a few minutes. Work that would have taken a surgeon much more time and certainly some light. It's simply not possible, and yet it happened. Tessa and Will considered the map in front of them for a moment while the fire crackled gently behind them. "You could have had a carriage," Will said. "Even with a carriage, there would simply not be time to commit these acts. And they are most certainly acts committed by the same being. Not the work of werewolves?" "Definitely not," Gabriel said. "Nor vampires. The bodies have not been drained, they have not been consumed or torn. They have been cut, with organs removed and arranged as if by design. This," Gabriel tapped the map for emphasis, "is demonic in nature, and it has set London into a panic." "But why would a demon target only these poor women?" Will asked. "There must be something they require. The fiend does not seem to take childbearing organs. I propose we patrol the East End, beginning at once this area." Gabriel drew a circle around Spitalfields with his finger. "This is the center of the activity. This is where it must be. Are we agreed?" "Where's Cecily?" Will asked. "She has already started the work. She is there now, speaking to some of the women on the street. They find it easier speaking to her, and we must start at once." Will nodded. "I have one further suggestion. As the beast seems to be attracted to a certain class of woman, we should use glamours, or shapeshifters," Tessa said, "to attract the demon." Will's eyes caught blue fire. "You are suggesting using my wife and my sister to lure the thing out?" "It is the best way," Gabriel said, "and your sister is my wife. Both Tessa and Cecily are more than capable, and we would be there as well." "It is a good plan," Tessa said, forestalling Will and Gabriel's next argument. There would always be time for another one. Gabriel nodded. "Again, are we agreed?" Tessa looked into her husband's bright blue eyes. "Agreed," she said. "Agreed," Will said, "on one condition." "And what condition is..." Gabriel broke off with a sigh. "Ah," he said, "Brother Zachariah." "This monster is violent," said Will. "We might need a healer, someone with the power of a silent brother. This is a special situation." "I cannot recall a situation you did not think was special and required his presence," Gabriel said dryly. "You have been known to call upon Brother Zachariah for a broken toe." "It was turning green," said Will. "He's right," said Tessa. "Green doesn't suit him, makes him look bilious." She smiled at Gabriel. "There is no reason for Jem not to accompany us. We may yet need him, and it does no harm to have him there." Gabriel opened his mouth and then closed it again with a click. He hadn't known Jem Carstairs that well before Jem had become a silent brother, but he had liked him. Still, unlike his wife, Gabriel was one of those people who, clearly, thought it odd that even though Tessa had once been engaged to Jem, she and Will considered him part of their family and tried to include him in everything they did. There were few people in the world who understood how much Will and Jem had loved each other, did love each other, and how much Will missed him. But Tessa did. "If we might be able to save one of these poor women, we must try," said Tessa. "If Jem can help, that would be wonderful. If not, Cecily and I will do all we can. I hope you do not think either of us lack the courage." Will stopped glaring at Gabriel and turned to Tessa. He looked at her and his face softened. The traces of the wild, broken boy he had been vanished, replaced with the expression often worn by the man he was now, who knew what it was to love and be loved. "Dear heart," he said. He took her hand and kissed it. "Who knows your courage better than I?" That October, Tessa Gray said, there were no Ripper murders reported. The London Institute made sure to patrol every evening, right through until sunrise. It was believed that this kept the demon at bay. It had gotten dark outside, even though it was only around 3 in the afternoon. The hall had gotten considerably colder as the sun had faded, and all of the students were hunkered down in the seats, arms wrapped around themselves to keep warm, but utterly alert. Tessa had been talking for some time, showing maps of London, describing truly horrific murders. It was the kind of thing that kept you awake. "I think," she said, rubbing her hands together, "that it's time for a short break. We'll resume in half an hour." During long lecture classes, the academy was merciful enough to allow one bathroom break every few hours, along with some more of the murky tea which was put out in one of the large halls in steaming, ancient urns. Simon was cold enough to take a cup. Again, some benevolent shadow hunter had provided a tray of small cakes. Simon was able to get a fleeting look at them before they were snatched up by the elites, who were excused first. Some sad little biscuits were left on the side. They looked like they were made of packed sand. "Good stuff today," George said, picking up a dry biscuit. "Well, not good, but more interesting than usual. I like the new teacher as well. You wouldn't think she was... How old is she?"
"I think 200 or something. Maybe older," said Simon.
His mind was elsewhere. Tessa Gray had mentioned two names, Jem Carstairs and Brother Zachariah. Apparently they were the same person, which was interesting because somewhere in Simon's shifting memories, he knew those names. And he remembered Emma Carstairs facing Jace. He couldn't remember why, but he knew it had happened, and saying, "the Carstairs owe the Herondales." There was something to this story that connected directly to Jace and to the Herondales in general. Simon was sure of it. He glanced over at Jace, who was seated in an armchair being waited on hand and foot by students.
"Miss Gray looks very good for 200, said George in an amused Scottish burr, looking over at where Tessa was examining the tea suspiciously.
As she moved away from the table, she cast a quick glance toward Jace. There was a wistful sadness in her expression. At that moment, Jace stood up from his chair, scattering hangers-on. The elites all moved to make way for him, and there was a quiet chorus of, "Hi, Jace!" and a few wheezing sighs as he made his way over to Simon and George.
"You did really well today," he said to George, who was flushed and appeared speechless.
Oh, right. Yeah, thanks, Jace. Thanks.
"Are you still sore?" Jace asked Simon.
"Mostly my pride."
"That's supposed to go with before a fall anyway." Simon winced at the joke.
"Really?"
"I've been waiting to say that for a while."
"That's not possible."
Jace's expression showed that it was indeed possible. Simon sighed.
"Look, Jace, if I could talk to you for a second."
"Anything you want to tell me can be sent around my good buddy George here."
"You're going to regret that," Simon thought. "Fine," he said. "Go talk to Tessa. We're between classes, so she should be free."
Jace blinked. "Tessa Gray? The warlock?"
"She used to be a shadow hunter," said Simon carefully. "Look, she was telling us a story, more of a piece of history, really, and you remember what Emma said, about the Carstairs owning the Herondales?"
Jace put his hands in his pockets.
"Sure,
I remember. I'm surprised you remember."
"I think you should talk to Tessa," said Simon. "I think she could tell you about the Herondales, things you don't know already."
Jace said. "I'll think about it."
He walked off. Simon looked after him, frustrated. He wished he could remember enough about how he and Jace interacted normally to know whether this meant Jace was going to ignore his advice or not.
"He treats you like a friend," George said. "Or an equal. You really did know each other. I mean, I knew that, but..."
Unsurprisingly, Jonathan Cartwright sidled up to them.
"Just talking to Jace, huh?" he said.
"Are you a detective?"
Simon replied.
"Your powers of observation are amazing."
Jonathan acted like Simon had never spoken.
"Yeah, Jace and I will catch up later."
"Are you really going to keep up the pretense that you know Jace?" Simon asked. "Because you know that's not going to work, right? Eventually Jace will just come over and say he doesn't know you."
Jonathan looked glum. Before he could say anything, though, the signal was given for everyone to return to the hall, and Simon shuffled in with the others. They took their seats again and settled in to listen to Tessa.
"We had decided to do nightly patrols of the area," Tessa began. "Our duty as shadow hunters is to protect the mundane world from the influence of demons. We walked, we watched, and we warned all those we could. As much as it was possible, women working in the East End tried to take more care and not walk alone as much. But for women in that profession, safety was rarely a consideration. I always assumed their lives were hard, but I had no idea."
London,
November 9th, 1888.
Tessa Herondale suddenly knew what poverty was, that it existed. In the time when her aunt had died and she was a young girl left friendless and defenseless in New York, she had felt the cold breath of poverty like a monster stalking at her back. But in the months she and Cecily spent walking the streets of East London under the guise of prostitutes, she knew what it would have been if poverty had caught her and torn at her with its claws. They dressed the part, old, tattered clothes, heavy rouge on the cheeks. They had to use glamours for the rest, for the true mark of the prostitute was want. Missing teeth, jaundiced skin, bodies tight from malnourishment and bent from disease. Women who walked and walked all night long because there was nowhere to sleep, nowhere to sit. They sold themselves for pennies to buy gin because the gin kept them warm. Took away the pain for an hour, numbed them to the terrible, brutal reality of their lives. If these women could get the money to have a place to sleep for the night, that didn't mean a bed. It could mean a spot on a floor, or even just a bit of wall to sit against with a rope run around the room to keep sleepers from falling over. By the crack of dawn, they'd be tossed out on the street again. Walking among them, Tessa felt dirty. She felt the remains of her supper in her belly. She knew that her bed in the Institute was warm and contained someone who loved her and would protect her. These women had bruises and cuts. They fought over corners in bits of cracked mirror and scraps of cloth. And there were children as well. They sat in the fetid streets no matter their age. Their skin was so dirty as to never be clean. She wondered how many of them had ever had a hot meal in their lives, served on a plate. Had they ever known a home? Over it all, the smell. The smell was what really ground itself into Tessa's soul. The tang of urine, the night soil, the vomit.
"I'm getting tired of this," said Cecily.
"I think everyone here is tired," Tessa replied. Cecily sighed sadly.
"One carriage ride away and the streets are quiet and spotless. It's a different world in the West End."
A drunken man approached them and made an overture. Since they had to play the part, Cecily and Tessa smiled and led him to an alley where they inserted him into an empty oyster barrel and left him.
"A month of this and no sign," Tessa said as they walked away from the flailing, upturned legs of the man. "Either we're keeping it away or... or this simply isn't working."
"Magnus Bain would be useful at a time like this."
"Magnus Bain is enjoying New York," Cecily replied.
"You're a warlock."
"I don't have Magnus's experience. Anyway, it's nearly dawn. Another hour and we can go home."
Will and Gabriel had taken to posting themselves in the Ten Bells pub, which seemed to be the central place for news of the killer. Indeed, many locals said they had seen him there with the victims before the murders. Sometimes Jem would come by with news from the Silent City. It wasn't unusual for Cecily and Tessa to return exhausted to the pub at the crack of dawn and find Gabriel gone and Will asleep, wrapped up in Brother Zachariah's parchment robes, head on the table. Jem would be reading a book or quietly looking at the window. He was glamoured, so that his appearance would not shock the tavern's denizens. Tessa could always feel Cecily tense when she first saw Jem. Black runes scored his cheeks, and there was a single white streak in his dark hair. Sometimes, after Cecily and Gabriel left, Tessa would sit with her hand in Jem's and Will sleeping against her shoulder, listening to the rain on the windows. It never did last long, though, since she did not like leaving the children alone so much, though Bridget was an excellent nurse. It was hard on both families. The children would wake to find four exhausted parents who drew endless runes for wakefulness and yet still could barely keep up with Anna, running about in her uncle's waistcoat, or James, waving his spoon and trying to find the dagger he had seen and loved. Lucy woke at all hours needing milk and embraces. And here it was, another dawn walking the streets of the East End, and for what? And the dawn was coming later and later. The nights were so very long. As the sun rose over Christchurch and Spitalfields, Cecily turned to Tessa again.
"Home," she said.
"Home," Tessa replied wearily. They had arranged for a carriage to come for them that morning on Gun Street. They met Will and Gabriel there. They looked a bit worse for wear, as they often had to drink gin all night in order to blend in with the locals. There had been no gin that night, and Will seemed restless.
"Did you find out anything?" Tessa asked.
"The same as usual," Gabriel said, slurring a little. All the victims were seen with a man. He varies in stature and all manner of appearance. So likely an Eidolon, Will said. It's so generic that it might even be a Dusian, but I don't think a Dusian could get that close and convince a woman he was an actual human male, no matter how drunk she was.
But that tells us nothing, Cecily said. If it's an Eidolon, it could be anyone.
It's been remarkably consistent, though, Will said. It always comes as a man, and it always takes women. We're getting nowhere with this. Or we're getting everywhere, Gabriel replied. It hasn't come back.
We can't do this forever. They'd been having this same conversation every night for the past week. This one ended as it usually did, with the two couples leaning against each other in the back of the carriage and falling asleep until they had reached the Institute. They greeted their children, who were having their breakfast with Bridget, and they listened with half-closed eyes as Anna rambled on about her many plans for the day, and James banged his spoon. Tessa and Will started the climb up the steps to their bedroom. Cecily waited for Gabriel, who was lingering in the front parlour.
"I'll be up shortly," he said, his eyes bloodshot. "I just want to read the morning papers."
Gabriel always did this, always checked every morning. So Tessa, Will, and Cecily returned to bed. Once in their bedroom, Tessa cleaned her face in the basin with the hot water Bridget had left. Their fire was burning and the bed was turned back, waiting for them. They fell into it gratefully. They had barely fallen asleep when Tessa heard a fevered banging at the door and Gabriel admitted himself.
"It's happened again," he said breathless. "By the angel, this is the worst one yet."
The carriage was recalled, and within the hour they were on their way back to the East End, this time dressed in gear.
"It happened in a place called Miller's Court off Dorset Street," Gabriel said.
Of all the terrible streets in East London, Dorset Street was the worst. It was a short row just off Commercial Street. Tessa had learned much of the goings-on of Dorset Street in the last few weeks. A pair of abusive slum landlords controlled much of the street. There was so much screaming, so much poverty and stench crowded into a small space it felt like it could push the air out of the lungs. The houses there were subdivided into tiny rooms, each little space rented away. This was a street where everyone had an empty stare, where the prevailing feeling was of desperation. On the way, Gabriel told them what he'd managed to find out from the morning papers. The address, number 13, the victim's name, Mary Kelly. There was a parade moving through the city for Lord Mayor's Day. News of the crime had spread, though, and was making its way along the parade route. Newspaper boys were chanting about the murder and selling papers like mad. Cecily peered out from the curtain of the carriage.
"They seem to be celebrating it," she said. "They're smiling and running to buy newspapers. My God, how can people celebrate such a thing?"
"It's interesting," Will said with a dark grin. "Danger is appealing, especially to those with nothing to lose." "It's going to be madness down there," Gabriel said.
Indeed, crowds had already gathered along the road to Dorset Street. The residents were all out watching the police. The police were attempting to hold people back from a small, dark doorway halfway up the road.
"There," Gabriel said. "Miller's Court. We won't be able to get near it unless you can get in, Tessa. There's a detective down there called Abberline from Scotland Yard. If we can get him over here, or one of the constables working inside the room..." "I'll get one of them," Will said, breaking through the crowd.
He returned a few minutes later with a man of middling age, with a kindly appearance. He did appear to be very busy, and his forehead was creased with consternation. Whatever Will had told him, it was enough to lure him away from the place of the crime.
"Where is it?" he said, following Will. "You're quite sure?" "Quite sure."
It was hard to keep people from following them, so Cecily, Tessa, and Gabriel had to block the way while Will led the inspector down an alley. He whistled a few moments later. He was standing in the doorway of a cheap rented room.
"In here,"
Will said. The inspector was in the corner looking quite asleep. His clothes were missing.
"He'll be fine, but he'll likely wake up soon. Put these on."
While Tessa took the clothes and changed herself into the form of Abberline, Will filled her in on a few more facts he had gotten from the people in the street. Mary Kelly was probably last seen at 2:30 in the morning, but one person claimed to have seen her as late as 8:30. No matter what, whatever had killed her had probably long since vanished. Once Tessa was ready, Will helped her push her way back through the crowd, down Dorset Street, to a small entryway that was Miller's Court. Tessa stepped through the dark passageway into a very small courtyard, barely wide enough to turn around in. There were several houses here, cheaply whitewashed. Dozens of faces peered at her from dirty, broken windows. Room 13 was barely a room. It was clearly part of a larger space in which a cheap partition had been constructed. It was mostly empty, containing only a few pieces of broken furniture. It was very, very hot, as if a fire had blazed all night. In all her time fighting demons, Tessa had never seen anything like this. There was blood. It was in such a large amount that Tessa wondered how one small body could contain so much. It had turned part of the floor black, and the bed on which the woman rested was utterly stained. There was no other color. As for the woman herself, she was no more. Her body was destroyed in a way that could barely be comprehended. This had taken time. Her face, there was nothing much left to speak of. Many parts of her were removed. They could be seen in many places, around her on the bed, some parts of her on the table. A man was leaning over her. There was a doctor's bag on the floor. So, Tessa steadied herself and then spoke.
"Well, doctor?"
The doctor turned.
"I think we'll have to move her soon. They're trying to break in. We'll have to move her carefully."
"Summarize for me the general situation. I need a concise report."
The doctor stood and wiped his blood-stained hands on his trousers.
"Well, a very deep cut across the throat. The head is nearly off. You can see the nose is gone, much of the skin. There are so many slashes and incisions in the abdomen, I barely know where to start. The abdominal cavity is empty and her hands have been placed inside the opening. You can see he's left some of the contents here in this room, but some are missing. The heart is gone, the skin on the table I believe to be from the thighs."
Tessa could not really take in much more of the information. This was enough.
"I see," she said. "There's someone I have to speak to."
"Make the arrangements for her to be moved," the doctor said. "We can't keep her here. They're going to get in. They want to see."
"Constable,"
Tessa said to a policeman by the door,
"see to it that a cart is brought."
Tessa walked away quickly, back down through the crowd, breathing in as deeply as she could to get the smell of blood and entrails out of her nose. She felt a queasiness she had not experienced since her pregnancies. Will took one look at her and embraced her. Cecily came forward and put smelling salts under her nose. They had learned that smelling salts were necessary.
"Bring out the detective,"
Tessa said, when she had recovered.
"He's needed."
The inspector was retrieved and dressed. The smelling salts were applied, and he slowly came around. Once they had him on his feet and assured him that he had simply fainted, they left the area quickly and walked toward White's Row.
"Whatever it was," Gabriel said, "it's likely long gone. It happened hours ago. By having the body indoors, it went unnoticed for some time."
He took out his sensor, but it showed no activity.
"I suggest we return to the Institute," he said. "We've learned what we can here. It's time to apply ourselves to the problem in a different way. We have to look at the clues it leaves behind."
"The people," Tessa said.
"The people,"
Gabriel corrected himself. They were more awake now. Tessa wondered if she would ever sleep again. She found the transition from East to West London more repugnant this time. The clean buildings, the space, the trees, the parks, the lovely carriages and the lovely clothes and shops. And just a mile or so away.
"What is done cannot be undone," Will said, taking her hand.
"You didn't see her."
"But we will catch the thing that attacked her."
As soon as they turned onto Fleet Street, Tessa felt something wasn't right. She couldn't figure out what it was. The street was utterly quiet. One of the servants from a neighboring property was sweeping leaves from the step. There was a coal cart and wagon from a greengrocer delivering vegetables. She sat upright, every nerve tense, and when the carriage stopped, she swung the door open quickly and bounded out. Seeing her reaction, the other three followed in a similar fashion. The first thing that confirmed her fears was that Bridget did not greet them at the door.
"Bridget?"
Tessa called. Nothing. She looked up at their windows. Clean, unbroken, dark. The curtains had been drawn. Will pushed open the door. They found Bridget at the foot of the staircase. Cecily rushed to her.
"Unconscious," she said. "But breathing, the children. Who's with the children?"
As one, they raced up the stairs. Every light was out, every door closed, every curtain drawn. They all went in separate directions, running to the nursery, to the bedrooms, to every room on the upper floors. Nothing.
"Shadow hunters."
The voice was neither male nor female, and it seemed to come from everywhere.
Will and Tessa met in the corridor, and Will held a witchlight high.
"What are you?"
he yelled.
"Where are the children?"
"Shadow hunters."
"Where are the children? You can't have an interest in them. Show yourself."
"Shadow hunters."
Gabriel and Cecily appeared, Seraph blades ready. Will and Tessa reached for theirs. They walked down the steps, watching in every direction.
"I follow you,"
hissed the voice, which now seemed to come from below them.
"Shadow hunters, I follow you home. Play my game."
"What is your game?"
Will called back.
"I'll play any game you like if you show yourself."
"The game is to hide. I like to hide. I like to take the pieces I hide. I take the pieces."
"I know you have form,"
Will said.
"You've been seen. Show yourself."
"Spoon."
The cry came from the direction of the dining room. All four ran toward the voice. When they opened the door, they found James standing at the far end of the room, spoon held aloft.
"James!"
Tessa cried.
"Come to Mama. Come now, James."
James laughed, and instead of running to Tessa, turned in the direction of the great fireplace, within which a tremendous fire burned high. He ran directly into it.
"James!"
Will and Tessa both ran for him, but halfway there, the fire flared up in a multitude of colors, blue and green and black. Heat poured from it, sending them stumbling back. It subsided as quickly as it had arisen. They dashed again for the fireplace, but there was no sign of James.
"No, no!"
Tessa screamed.
"Jamie!"
She lunged for the fire. Will caught her and hauled her back. Everything seemed to have gone dark and silent in Tessa's ears. All she could think about was her baby. His soft laugh, his storm-black hair like his father's, his sweet disposition. The way he put his arms around her neck, his lashes against his cheeks. Somehow she had fallen to the floor. It was hard against her knees.
"James,"
she thought desperately. A cool hand closed about her wrist. There were words in her head, soft and silent, cool as water. "I am here." Her eyes flew open. Jem was kneeling over her. The hood of his robes was thrown back, his black and silver hair disarrayed. "It's all right, that was not James. That was the demon itself tricking you. James is in the house." Tessa gasped.
"My God! Is that the truth?"
Strong arms were suddenly around her, hugging her tight.
"It's true. James had a tracking spell on Lucy and James since they were born. They're alive, they just need us to find them. Tess.
Tessa."
She felt Will's tears against her shoulder. Jem was still holding her hand. "I called for James," she thought, "and he came." Tessa stayed where she was. It was the first time in her life she thought that her legs had felt so weak that she couldn't rise. Will had his arms around her, and her hand was in Jem's. That was enough to keep her breathing. "The Silent City believes the demon to be a sort of trickster. It means for you to chase it around the Institute. Its motives are unclear, but they seem to be those of a child." "If it is a child," Tessa began, almost to herself. The others turned to her. "If it's a child, it thinks it's playing a game. It's playing with women. I think it wants a mother." Suddenly, it was as if a great wind shook the room.
"I will play,"
called a different voice.
"Jessamine,"
Will said.
"She's inside the house."
"I will play with you,"
said Jessamine's voice, louder now. It seemed to come from every room.
"I have toys, I have a dollhouse. Play with me."
There was a long silence. Then all of the gas jets flared, sending columns of blue flame almost to the ceiling. Just as quickly, they were sucked back down the jets and the room was dark again. The fire went out.
"My dollhouse is wonderful,"
Jessamine's voice went on.
"It is very small."
"Very small,"
came the reply.
"Bring the children and we shall play."
There was another great whoosh of wind through the room.
"Jessamine's room,"
Will said. They made their way carefully to Jessamine's room where the door stood open. There was Jessamine's dollhouse, her pride and joy, and next to it, the transparent, gossamer figure of jessamine. A moment later, something came down the chimney, a kind of fog that splintered into pieces and floated about the room like bits of cloud. Jessamine was busy moving about the dolls in one of the rooms and paid attention to no one.
"We need more of us to play," she said.
"It is very small, so many pieces."
The fog drifted toward the dollhouse, but Jessamine suddenly flared. She became like a web, wrapping herself around the dollhouse.
"We need more of us to play," Jessamine hissed. "The children. They are in the walls."
"In the walls?" Gabriel said.
"How can they..."
"The chimneys," Cecily said. "It uses the chimneys." They ran from room to room. Each child was found sound asleep, tucked up into a chimney. Anna was in one of the empty Shadowhunter rooms. James was in the kitchen. Lucy was in Cecily and Gabriel's bedroom. Once they were secured along with Bridget, they returned to Jessamine's room where the shimmering figure of Jessamine was playing with a small girl. Jessamine appeared to be utterly engrossed in the game until she saw the others, who nodded to her.
"Now we will play a new game," Jessamine said.
The small girl turned towards Jessie, and Tessa caught sight of her face. It was pale and smooth, a child's face, but her eyes were entirely black, with no whites to them at all. They looked like specks of ash.
"Know this game?"
"You must close your eyes. It is a very good game. We are going to hide."
"Hide?"
"Yes, we shall play hide and seek. You must close your eyes."
"I like to hide."
"But first you must seek. Close your eyes." The demon child, a small girl, barely 5 years of age in appearance, closed her eyes. As she did, Will brought the Seraph Blade down on her, and the room was splattered with ichor. "And it was gone," Tessa said. The problem, of course, was that the rest of London couldn't be told that it was over. Jack the Ripper had been conjured up out of thin air, and now there was no Jack the Ripper to put in the dock. There would be no capture, no trial, no public hanging. The killing simply stopped. We considered trying to stage something, but there was so much scrutiny by that point that we felt this might complicate matters. But as it turned out, we didn't need to do anything. The public and the newspapers carried the story. New things were published every day, even though we knew there was nothing to report. It turned out people were willing to make up many theories of their own, and they've continued to do so since 1888. Everyone wants to catch the uncatchable killer. Everyone wants to be the hero of the story. And this has remained true in many cases since. In the absence of facts, the media will often make up stories of their own. It can save us a lot of work. In many ways, modern media is one of our greatest assets when it comes to covering up the truth. Do not discount mundanes. They weave their own stories to make sense of their world. Some of you mundanes will help us make better sense of ours. "Thank you for your attention this afternoon," Tessa finished. "I wish you all the luck in the world as you continue your training. What you do is brave and important."
"A round of applause for our esteemed guest," Katerina said.
This was given, and Tessa stepped down and went over to a man, who kissed her lightly on the cheek. He was slender and very elegant, dressed in black and white. His black hair had one single white streak in it, completing the dichromatic look. Memories assailed Simon, some easy to access, some hidden behind the frustrating web of forgetfulness. Jem had been at Luke and Jocelyn's wedding as well. The way that he smiled at Tessa, and she back at him, made it clear what their relationship was. They were in love, of the realest, truest kind. Simon thought of Tessa's story of the Jem who had been a silent brother, and had been part of her life so long ago. Silent brothers did live a long time. And Simon's foggy memory did recall something about one who had been returned to normal mortal life by heavenly fire, which meant that Jem had lived in a silent city for over 100 years until his service was over. He had returned to life to live with his immortal love. Now that was a complicated relationship. It made a little memory loss and former vampire status seem almost normal. Dinner that night was a new culinary terror. Mexican food. There were roast chickens, or pollo asado, with the feathers still on, and square tortillas. Jace didn't appear. Simon didn't have to look around for him, as the entire cafeteria was on alert. Had there been a sighting of his mighty blonde head, Simon would have heard the intake of breath. Dinner was followed by 2 hours of mandatory study in the library. After all that, Simon and George returned to their room only to find Jace standing by the door.
"Evening," he said.
"Seriously?" Simon said.
"How long have you been lurking here?"
"I wanted to talk to you."
Jace had his hands stuffed in his pockets and was leaning against the wall, looking like an advertisement for a fashion magazine.
"Alone."
"People will say we're in love," Simon said.
"You could come into our room," George said, "if you want to talk. If it's private, I can put earplugs in."
"I'm not going in there," Jace said, glancing in the open doorway. "That room is so damp you could probably hatch frogs on the walls."
"Ah, that would be in my head, no?" George said. "I hate frogs."
"So what do you want?" Simon said. Jace smiled lightly. "George, go inside the room," Simon said, a bit apologetically. "I'll be right in." George ducked into their bedroom and shut the door behind him. Simon was now alone with Jace in a long corridor, which was a situation he felt like he'd been in before.
"Thank you," Jace said surprisingly directly.
"You were right about Tessa." "She's related to you?"
"I went to talk to her."
Jace looked shyly pleased, as if a small light inside him had been turned on. It was the sort of expression that would, Simon suspected, have slain adolescent girls in their tracks.
"She's my great-great-great-something grandmother. She was married to Will Herondale. I've learned about him before. He was part of stopping a massive demon invasion into Britain. She and Will were the first Herondales to run the London Institute. I mean, it isn't anything I didn't know historically, but it's, well, as far as I know, there isn't anyone alive who shares blood with me. But Tessa does."
Simon leaned back against the wall of the corridor. "Did you tell Clary?"
"Yeah, I was on the phone with her for a couple of hours. She said that Tessa hinted at some of this stuff during Luke and Jocelyn's wedding, but she didn't come right out and say it. She didn't want me to feel burdened."
"Do you?" Simon said. "Feel burdened, that is."
"No," Jace said. "I feel like there's someone else who understands what it means to be a Herondale. Both the good parts and the bad. I worried because of my father, that maybe being a Herondale meant I was weak. And then I learned more and thought maybe I was expected to be some kind of hero."
"Yeah," Simon said. "I know what it's like." They shared a small moment of bizarre, companionable silence. The boy who'd forgotten everything about his history, and the boy who'd never known it. Simon broke the silence. "Are you going to see her again? Tessa?"
"She says she's going to take me and Clary on a tour of Herondale House in Idris."
"Did you meet Jem, too?"
"We've met before," said Jace. "In the Basilius in Idris. You don't remember, but I..."
"Stopped him being a silent brother," said Simon. "I did remember that."
"We talked in Idris," said Jace. "A lot of what he said makes more sense to me now."
"So you're happy?"
Simon said.
"I'm happy," said Jace.
"I mean, I've been happy, really, since the Dark War ended. I've got Clary and I've got my family. The only dark spot's been you. Not remembering Clary, or Izzy, or me."
"So sorry to mess up your life with my inconvenient amnesia," Simon muttered.
"I didn't mean it that way," Jace said. "I meant I wish you remembered me because..."
He sighed.
"Forget it."
"Look, Herondale, you owe me one now. Wait out here."
"For how long?"
Jace looked aggrieved. "As long as it takes." Simon ducked into his room and shut the door. George, who'd been lying in bed studying, looked glum when Simon informed him that Jace was lurking in the hall.
"He's making me nervous now," George said. "Who'd want Jace Herondale following them around, being all mysterious and taciturn and blonde? Oh, right, probably loads of people. Still, I wish he wouldn't."
Simon didn't bother to lock the bedroom door, partially because there were no locks at the Shadowhunter Academy, and partially because if Jace decided to come in and stand over Simon's bed all night,
he was going to do that, lock or no. "He must want something," George said, stripping off his rugby shirt and throwing it into the corner of the room. "Is this a test? Are we going to have to fight Jace in the middle of the night? Say, not to bag on our awesome demon-fighting prowess, but I do not think that's a fight we can win." "I don't think so," Simon said, dropping down onto his bed, which dropped much farther than it should have. That was definitely at least two springs breaking. They got ready for bed. As usual, in the dark, they talked about the mold and the many zoological possibilities crawling around them in the dark. He heard George turn toward the wall, the signal that he was about to sleep and the nightly chat was over. Simon was awake, hands behind his head, body still achingly sore from the fallout of the tree. There were many lessons he probably should have taken from the lecture today. The one he took now was, sometimes you need to write a letter. Granted, this would be a very different letter for a very different reason. "Do you mind if I turn on a light?" Simon asked.
"Nah, go ahead. I can barely see it anyway."
They still said turn on a light like they were flicking a switch. They had candles at the academy, nubby little candles that seemed to have been specially made to produce as little light as possible. Simon fumbled around on the small stand next to his bed and found his matches and lit his candle, which he pulled into the bed with him, balancing it on his lap in a way that was probably unsafe. One good thing about the floor of ultimate moisture was that it was unlikely to catch fire. He could still be burned if the candle overturned in his lap, but it was the only way he would be able to see to write. He reached again for some paper and a pen. No texting here. No typing. Real pen to paper was required. He made a makeshift desk out of a book and began to write. "Dear Isabel." Should he start with "dear"? It was the way you started letters, but now that he saw it, it looked weird and old-fashioned and maybe too intimate. He got a new piece of paper. "Isabel." Well, that looked stark, like he was angry just saying her name like that. Another paper. "Izzy." No, definitely not. They were not at pet names yet. How the hell did you start a letter like this? Simon considered a casual, "Hey," or maybe just forgetting the salutation and getting right to the message. Texting was so much easier than this. He picked up the paper that started with "Isabel" again. It was the middle choice. He would have to go with that. "Isabel. I fell out of a tree today. I'm thinking of you while I'm in my moldy bed. I saw Jace today. He may develop food poisoning. Just wanted you to know. I'm Batman. I'm trying to figure out how to write this letter." Okay, that was a possible start and true. "Let me tell you something you already know. You're amazing. You know it, I know it, anyone can see that. Here's the problem. I don't know what I am. I have to figure out who I am before I can accept that I'm someone who deserves someone like you. It's not something I can accept just because I've heard it. I need to know that guy. And I know I am that guy you loved. I just have to meet him. I'm trying to figure out how that happens. I guess it happens here, in this school where they try to kill you every day. I think it takes time. I know things that take time are annoying. I know it's hard, but I have to get there the hard way. This letter is probably stupid. I don't know if you're still reading. I don't know if you're going to rip it up or slice it in half with your whip or what." All of that came out in one solid flow. He tapped the pen against his forehead for a minute. "I'm going to give this to Jace to give to you. He's been trailing me around all day like some kind of JC shadow. He's either here to make sure I don't die, or to make sure I die. Or maybe because of you. Maybe you sent him. I don't know. He's Jace. Who knows what he's doing? I'm going to give this to him. He may read it before it gets to you. Jace, if you're reading this, I'm pretty sure you're going to get food poisoning. Do not use the bathrooms." It wasn't romantic, but he decided to leave it in. It might make Isabel laugh. "If you are reading this, Jace, stop now. Izzy, I don't know why you would wait for me, but if you do, I promise to make myself worth that wait. Or I'll try. I can promise I am going to try. Simon." Simon opened the door and was not surprised to find Jace standing outside of it. "Here," Simon said, handing him the letter. "Took you long enough," Jace said. "Now we're even," said Simon. "Go party in the Herondale house with your weird family." "I plan to," said Jace, and smiled a sudden, strangely endearing smile. He had a chipped tooth. The smile made him seem like he was Simon's age, and maybe they were friends after all.
"Good night, Wiggles."
"Wiggles?" Jace turned.
"Yes, Wiggles. Your nickname? It's what you always made us call you. I almost forgot your name was Simon. I'm so used to calling you Wiggles."
"Wiggles? What does that even mean?"
"You would never explain," Jace said with a shrug. "It was the big mystery about you. As I said, good night, Wiggles. I'll take care of this."
He held up the letter and used it to make a salute. Simon shut the door. He knew most people on the hall had probably heard that exchange. He knew that in the morning he would be called Wiggles, and there was nothing he would ever be able to do about it. But it was a small price to pay to get a letter to Isabel.
Nothing But Shadows. Read by Nico Mirallegro.
I knew nothing but shadows, and I thought them to be real. Oscar Wilde. Shadowhunter Academy, 2008. The afternoon sunlight was streaming warm through the arrow-slit windows of their classroom, painting the grey stone walls yellow. The elites and the dregs alike were sleepy from a long morning of training with Scardsbury, and Katerina Loss was giving them a history lesson. History applied to both the elites and the dregs, so they could all learn of the glory of the Shadowhunters and aspire to be part of that glory. In this class, Simon thought none of them seemed that different from each other. Not that they were all united in aspiring to glory, but they were all equally glazed with boredom. Until Marisol answered a question correctly, and John Cartwright kicked the back of her chair.
"Awesome!" Simon hissed behind his book. "That's really cool behavior. Congratulations, John. Every time a Mundy answers a question wrong, you say it's because they can't rise to the level of Shadowhunters. And every time one of us answers a question right, you punish them. I have to admire your consistency."
George Lovelace leaned back in his chair and grinned, feeding Simon his next line.
"I don't see how that's consistent, Si."
"Well, he's consistently a jackass," Simon explained.
"I can think of a few other words for him," George remarked. "But some of them cannot be used around ladies, and some of them are Gaelic and cannot be understood by you mad foreigners."
John looked upset. Possibly he was upset that their chairs were too far away to kick.
"I just think she shouldn't speak out of turn," he said. "It's true that if you Mundys listen to us shadow hunters," said Julie, "you might learn something."
"If you Shadowhunters ever listened," said Sunil, a Mundy boy who lived down the slimy hall from George and Simon, "you might learn a few things yourself." Voices were rising. Katerina was beginning to look very annoyed. Simon gestured to Marisol and John to be quiet, but they both ignored him. Simon felt the same way as when he and Clary had set a fire in his kitchen by trying to toast grapes and create raisins when they were six. Amazed and appalled that things had gone wrong so fast. Then he realized that was a new memory. He grinned at the thought of Clary, with exploded grape in her red hair, and let the classroom situation escalate.
"I'll teach you some lessons down in the training grounds," John snapped. "I could challenge you to a duel. Watch your mouth."
"That's not a bad idea," remarked Marisol.
"Oh, hey now," said Beatrice. "Duels with 14-year-olds are a bad idea."
Everyone looked with scorn upon Beatrice, the voice of reason. Marisol sniffed. "Not a duel, a challenge. If the elites beat us in a challenge, then they get to speak out first in class for a week. If we beat them, then they hold their tongues."
"I'll do it, and you'll be sorry you ever suggested it, Mundy."
What's the challenge? John asked. Staff, sword, bow, dagger work, a horse race, a boxing match. I'm ready. Marisol smiled sweetly. Baseball. Cue mass puzzlement and panic looks among the shadow hunters. I'm not ready, George whispered. I'm not American and I don't play baseball. Is it like cricket, Si? Or more like hurling? You have a sport called hurling in Scotland? Simon whispered back. What do you hurl? Potatoes? Small children? Weird. I'll explain later, said George. I'll explain baseball, said Marisol, with a glint in her eye. Simon had the feeling Marisol was going to be a terrifying tiny expert on baseball, the same way she was at fencing. He also had the feeling the elite stream was in for a surprise. And I will explain how a demonic plague almost wiped out the shadow hunters, said Katerina loudly from the front of the class. Or I would, if my students would stop bickering and listen for 1 minute. Everybody went very quiet and listened meekly about the plague. It was only when the lesson ended that everyone started talking about the baseball game again. Simon had at least played before, so he was hurrying to put away his books and go outside when Katerina said, Daylighter, wait. Really, Simon would be fine, Simon told her.
The elite kids are trying to replicate the school they have heard about from their parents, Katerina said.
Monday students are meant to be seen and not heard, to soak up the privilege of being among shadow hunters and prepare for their ascension or death in a spirit of humility. Except you really have been stirring up trouble among them. Simon blinked. Are you telling me not to be so hard on the shadow hunters because it's just the way they were raised? Be as hard on the smug little idiots as you like, said Katerina. It's good for them. I'm just telling you so you realize what an effect you're having and what an effect you could have. You're in an almost unique position, Daylighter. I only know of one other student who dropped from the elites to the dregs, not counting Lovelace, who would have been in the dregs from the beginning if the Nephilim didn't make smug assumptions. But then, smug assumptions are their favorite thing. That had the effect Katerina must have known it would. Simon stopped trying to fit his copy of the Shadow Hunter's Codex into his bag and sat down. The rest of the class would take some time to prepare before they actually had the baseball game. Simon could spare a little while. Was he a mundane too? No, he was a shadow hunter, Katerina said. He went to the academy more than a century ago. His name was James Herondale.
A Herondale? Another Herondale? Simon asked.
Herondales without cease. Do you ever get the feeling you're being chased around by Herondales?
Not really, Katerina said.
Not that I'd mind. Magnus says they tend to be a good-looking lot. Of course, Magnus always says they tend to be strange in the head. James Herondale was a bit of a special case.
Let me guess, Simon said. He was blonde, smug, and adored by the populace.
Katerina's ivory eyebrows rose.
No, I recall Ragnar mentioning he had dark hair and spectacles. There was another boy at school, Matthew Fairchild, who did answer to that description. They did not get along particularly well.
Really? Said Simon, and reconsidered.
Well then, Team James Herondale.
I bet that Matthew guy was a jackass.
Oh, I don't know, said Katerina. I always thought he was a charmer myself. Most people did. Everybody liked Matthew.
This Matthew guy must have been a charmer, Simon thought. Katerina rarely spoke about any shadow hunters with anything like approval. But here she was, smiling fondly over a boy from 100 years ago.
Everybody except James Herondale? Simon asked.
The shadow hunter who got thrown out of the shadow hunter course. Did Matthew Fairchild have anything to do with that?
Katerina stepped out from behind her teacher's desk and went to the arrow-slit window. The rays of the dying sun struck through her hair in brilliant white lines, almost giving her a halo, but not quite.
James Herondale was the son of angels and demons, she said softly. He was always fated to walk a difficult and painful path,
to drink bitter water with sweet, to tread where there were thorns as well as flowers. Nobody could save him from that. People did try. Shadowhunter Academy, 1899. James Herondale told himself that he was feeling sick only because of the jolting of the carriage. He was really very excited to be going to school. Father had borrowed Uncle Gabriel's new carriage so he could take James from Alicante to the academy, just the two of them. Father had not asked if he could borrow Uncle Gabriel's carriage. "Don't look so serious, Jamie," Father said, murmuring a Welsh word to the horses that made them trot faster. "Gabriel would want us to have the carriage. It's all between family. Uncle Gabriel mentioned last night that he had recently had the carriage painted, many times. And he has threatened to summon the constabulary and have you arrested," said James. "Many times. Gabriel will stop fussing about it in a few years." Father winked one blue eye at James. "Because we will all be driving automobiles by then." "Mother says you can never drive an automobile," said James. "She made me and Lucy promise that if you ever did, we would not climb into it." "Your mother was just joking." James shook his head. "She made us swear on the angel." He grinned up at his father. Father shook his head at Jamie, the wind catching at his black hair. Mother said Father and Jamie had the same hair. But Jamie knew his own hair was always untidy. He had heard people call his father's hair unruly, which meant being untidy with charisma. The first day of school was not a good day for James to be thinking about how very different he was from his father. During their drive from Alicante, several people stopped them on the road, calling out their usual exclamation, "Oh, Mr. Herondale!" Shadowhunter ladies of many ages said that to his father. Three words that were both sigh and summons. Other fathers were called Mr. without the O prefix. With such a remarkable father, people tended to look for a son who would be perhaps a lesser star to Will Herondale's blazing sun, but still someone shining. They were always subtly but unmistakably disappointed to find James, who was not very remarkable at all. James remembered one incident that made the difference between him and his father starkly apparent. It was always the tiniest moments that came back to James in the middle of the night and mortified him the very most, like it was always the almost invisible cuts that kept stinging. A mundane lady had wandered up to them at Hatchard's bookshop in London. Hatchard's was the nicest bookshop in the city, James thought, with its dark wood and glass front, which made the whole shop look solemn and special, and its secret nooks and hidey holes inside where one could curl up with a book and be quite quiet. James's family often went to Hatchard's altogether, but when James and his father went alone, ladies quite often found a reason to wander over to them and strike up a conversation. Father told the lady that he spent his days hunting evil and rare first editions. Father could always find something to say to people, could always make them laugh. It seemed a strange, wondrous power to James, as impossible to achieve as it would be for him to shapeshift like a werewolf. James did not worry about ladies approaching Father. Father never once looked at any woman the way he looked at Mother, with joy and thanksgiving, as if she was a living wish, granted past all hope. James did not know many people, but he was good at being quiet and noticing. He knew that what lay between his parents was something rare and precious. He worried only because the ladies approaching Father were strangers James would have to talk to. The lady in the bookshop had leaned down and asked, "And what do you like to do, little man?" "I like books," James had said, while standing in the bookshop with a parcel of books under his arm. The lady had given him a pitying look. "I read, rather a lot," James went on, dreary, master of the obvious. King of the obvious. Emperor of the obvious. The lady was so unimpressed that she wandered off without another word. James never knew what to say to people. He never knew how to make them laugh. He had lived 13 years of his life,
mainly at the Institute in London, with his parents and his little sister Lucy, and a great many books. He had never had a